Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. One of the best parts of being a game master is creating your own world. The 5th edition of D&D has inspired me to finally take the plunge. Today, I set off again on the Obsidian Monolith to discuss my new D&D world, Primordia. I'll discuss the Adventurers Guild in my world, how the portals work, and my first city, Alondria. So join me on the journey. Together, we can become game masters truly worthy of the title. Hello, listener. Greetings, fellow GM and or player. Welcome to episode 63 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker, and I'm transmitting to you today from the Obsidian Monolith somewhere outside time and space. So this is a continuation of episode 62. So that was world building episode number 7. This is world building episode number 8. It's actually all one recording that I did, sick with the flu. But it actually turned out surprisingly well, considering that I had a low-grade fever and was feeling pretty crappy. So I think it turned out all right, considering. So today I'm going to talk some more about my world. I'm going to continue discussing a little bit about the deities. I've got a little bit more info on a few of them. And then I'm going to talk about my Adventurers Guild and my cities and my portals and talk a little bit about the first city where we're starting out in the campaign. So I have, with some of the deities, I've started coming up with some more specific things. So I just have three of those. So I thought I'd share those with you real quick. So Hanalei, I was reading the entry on Soon in the Sword Coast book, and I really like some of the stuff about Soon. So I'm stealing a lot of it. One thing that I really like that I'm using with my goddess of life and love and healing and all that stuff is that priests of Hanalei value beauty in all its forms. They do everything in their power to make themselves as beautiful as possible and are widely viewed as the most beautiful and stylish people in the world. This goes a step further in that priests of Hanalei pride themselves on being able to present themselves as a beautiful specimen of any gender. Notice I didn't say either gender, implying there's more than two. This means that a priest of Hanalei might one day appear as a beautiful woman, the next as a beautiful man, and the following day as a beautiful androgynous person. However, they believe in the truth of beauty. Makeup and wardrobe are used to enhance what's there, not try to falsify one's appearance, so they won't be using magic to look like someone else. Gender is seen as a role that one plays and can be changed as easily as changing clothes or an actor playing a different part. So that's why, you know, my priests of Hanalei will not use magic to disguise themselves, but they don't have a problem with, for instance, if this particular priest is a man, appear like making himself look like a beautiful woman. Again, not using magic, just using makeup and dress and how he walks and stuff like that. Because again, that's not deceiving anything, because the gender of man versus woman or whatever, it's to them, it's meaningless. It's just like a set of clothes you put on. It's not who you are. It's just a mask, right? And changing masks is no big deal. But trying to make people see you as something that you aren't is a big deal. So that's Hanalei, and that's one I really want a different name for, obviously, because this is probably very different from Hanalei, the goddess or the elven goddess of love. I came a little bit on my god of war, Tempest, just to explain like how this god even exists right now. The faith of Tempest values honorable combat to resolve conflicts that cannot be resolved non-violently. Of course, there are different factions, but the most common faction strives to make wars short, decisive, and honorable with the least amount of bloodshed possible. two generals who are followers of Tempest might decide to settle things with a personal duel so each of their armies can return home to their families. So very different from my original thought of a God of War, that I was going to have more like an Ares God of War and like bloodlust and stuff like that, kind of more of a chaotic evil god. But since war like that doesn't really exist in my world right now, it didn't really make sense. And thank you, Steve, for pointing that out. It's a great thing about having players help you with world building is they'll find those plot holes for you. And then my goddess, Primordia. Primordia is the goddess of nature in its creative aspects and is one of the most widely worshipped deities in Primordia. She is usually perceived as female, although some cultures and individuals may perceive her as male. Primordia has a wide variety of aspects, nearly one for every culture that honors her. An agricultural society will focus on her role as the goddess of agriculture and will especially honor her during planting season in the spring and harvest season in the fall. She is also associated with the fertility and health of livestock. In these cultures, she is often considered a close ally of Ioun, the goddess of civilization and culture. Her priests will tend to dress in greens and yellows in the spring and browns and oranges in the fall. Her temples will be adorned with symbols of agriculture. These cultures tend to view Primordia as being in opposition of Talos. Talos represents the more destructive side of nature, and his storms are often disastrous to farmers. On the other hand, a society that relies on hunting and foraging will focus on her role as the goddess of the hunt, plants, and animals. Primordia is invoked at the beginning of a hunt or foraging expedition in the hopes that she will provide success in the endeavor, and she is thanked when a hunt or forage is successful. A holy time for these people is often the winter solstice, when the night is longest and Primordia's blessing is needed most. Her priests tend to be adorned with symbols of the most sought-after game in the area, whether that be actual furs, bones, antlers, etc. These cultures tend to see Primordia and Talos as a couple of siblings who one day may fight and the next day be best friends. So that's just kind of an example of how I imagine different cultures and different areas in my world, and even different individuals, as seeing the gods differently. But they're not different gods. Like Primordia, you know, you could look at her as worshipped by a hunting society versus her as worshipped by a agricultural society, and they may seem like two different gods, and in reality they would probably have different names. Again, I'm trying to avoid that just for simplicity and to avoid confusing my players. You know, you might think that they're, because their priests look different, they act different, their holy days are different, their temples are built differently and decorated differently, and they consider different things to be symbols of the god. So you could think that they were two totally different gods, but it's the same god, just seen very differently by different people and different cultures. And my hope with that is first of all, it makes a lot of sense. And second of all, you know, it allows me to have later, when I want to kind of dig deeper into things, I can have different cultures that have different beliefs and, you know, different styles of worship and stuff like that, without having to, every time I come up with a new country or something, I got to invent a new pantheon. And I end up with like the Forgotten Realms, where I've got more gods than you can remember. Instead, it's like, well, no, there's only, say, nine gods, but those gods are seen in a lot of different ways by different people. So you go on the whole other side of the world, and you may not even be able to recognize them, and you might have fun trying to figure out, like, who are these gods, but it's still the same god. I'm still thinking about my Adventurers Guild, and I still haven't come up with a cool name, so right now I'm just going with Adventurers Guild. Generic yet descriptive, right? And I'm just going to call them Adventurers. I got a great suggestion from Matt Martinez. So I want to thank Matt for his suggestion on Google Plus. And Matt says, would it be possible that the adventurers in your guild are part of something called, for example, the Explorer Society? The concept could be that it has been established by a collective of academic institutions to find out as much about the history of Primordia as possible. Since scholars aren't always the strongest, most capable folks, they would most definitely need soldiers, bodyguards to protect them during their expeditions. One of the incentives for non-scholarly adventurers could be that they are allowed to keep any treasure they find, provided they give items that appear to have historical significance to the society leadership, which would in turn grant them an added bonus. That's a great idea, and it's funny because I'd actually considered doing something like that in the very beginning, but I kind of rejected it out of hand without really thinking about it a whole lot, just because, well, that's basically what the Pathfinder Society is, right? And I wanted to try to differentiate my Adventurers Guild from the Pathfinder Society so it's not just exactly the same thing. But reading this from Matt, I was like, you know, that perfectly fits my world, right? Like, I'm establishing that this world is really old and there's these ancient magics that have been forgotten. And it makes sense that something like the Pathfinder Society or what Matt is calling an Explorer Society would exist. So I decided, you know what, I should just do what I want to do and not worry about if it's too much like the Pathfinder Society or not. So this kind of got the ball rolling for me and led me to have another idea, which is a natural fit for my Adventurers Guild, which you'll remember that I mentioned before in an earlier world building episode about how I had this idea that when adventurers retire, they would be the ones to guard the portals in the cities and protect them and keep them safe. And I started thinking about what would be involved in establishing a new portal, right? So let's say you've got City A and you've got City B, who's, you know, far away, maybe on the other side of a sea or on the other side of a mountain or just, you know, really far away, whatever, right? And they're going to build a portal to connect each other. I like the idea that someone has to travel from one city to the other to make this happen. And the reason is all of my cities are protected by mythals, or at least all the ones that still exist. The others were destroyed. And of course, the various mythals will be different. But the one thing that they pretty much all have in common is they do not allow teleportation magic to function. So that's why, you know, a wizard just can't teleport from city A to city B. He has to use a portal because, first of all, the mythal around city A won't let him teleport. And the mythal around city B won't let him teleport, right? So There's got to be a portal, and that also explains, you know, why someone has to physically go from city A to city B to hook the portals up, right? And I haven't decided exactly how the portals are built, but I'm thinking of using something like a capstone for the portal kind of thing, and the idea is that, you know, you start in city A and you build this portal. And the way that you connect it to the portal in City B is you basically take the capstone of the portal and you create a magical duplicate, like you magically clone it, basically. And then you take that capstone to City B and you build a portal in City B using that capstone, and that attunes and links the two portals together. And I'm definitely going with the, you know, one portal goes one place as far as these portals between cities, so that if I have a city, if city A has five other cities that it trades with and is friendly with, then when you go to where the portals are, there's going to be five portals, one for each city. And I just decided that I just like that better than having like a Stargate kind of portal that could go various places. I like the idea of each pair of portals, it kind of, the idea is there's really only one portal, right? That portal between city A and city B is one portal that exists in two places at the same time, is kind of the idea, or it's like the two ends of a wormhole or something like that. And that's why, you know, someone has to build the portal in city A and then go build the portal in city B and go through all these hoops to make them connected in the same so that they function properly. So the idea I came up with is, well, that sounds like a job for the Adventurers Guild, right? Like, somebody's got to go to City B and set up this portal. So I decided that not only does the Adventurers Guild protect the portals, but they actually create them and maintain them. So that's one of the big jobs of the Adventurers Guild is they're the portal masters. So they're the ones that create and build and maintain and protect these portals that connect my cities together. But I really like Matt's idea of having this guild also very interested in uncovering knowledge and artifacts and magic items and whatnot from the previous ages and the previous civilizations. So I think that's a great idea. I think it makes perfect sense. You know, so basically the Adventurers Guild, they build and maintain and protect the portals between the cities. They protect the cities and any other settled areas from the monsters and whatnot in the countryside and try to keep that stuff under control. They will investigate and deal with any major planar breaches, like if there's some huge rift to another plane that opens near a city and it doesn't close and things are pouring out of it. The Adventurers Guild is the one that's going to send people to deal with that. And they explore the world looking for old magics and new knowledge and whatnot to make themselves more powerful, make their agents more powerful, to have money to be able to do the things that they want to do, and also in the hopes of, you know, being able to improve their portals or being able to improve the mythals around the city. Oh, a city. I can tell you about my city, right? So as often happens when you're a DM, I got thrown for a loop because, and I did this myself. I did this to myself. I can't blame the players for this one because all along, you know, I told you how I'm going micro to macro, and you can't get much more micro than a village, right? And back when I first started thinking about creating my own world way back months ago in Indiana, I was thinking that I would start with a little village. Because then I have a very small amount of NPCs to deal with. It just keeps things really manageable, right? And this can be the home base that the PCs go out from and everything and have adventures. And also, you know, it gives them the opportunity to be like the heroes of the town, right? Well, as I recently started developing my world more, and I came up with, you know, my cities connected by portals and the wilds in between are just crazy and people don't go there, I realized that this made a real problem for villages, because how does a village fit into this, right? And so what I've decided is there are villages, they do exist, but they're rare. And a village is a problem because the cities, like the way I decide my city of Alondria, which is my first city I've created where the campaign is starting, is there's the inner city, which was actually built by elves thousands of years ago and is all elven architecture. And surrounded by a wall that's, you know, not just a physical wall, but magical as well. And then around that is the outer city that was built, instead of thousands of years ago, was built hundreds of years ago by humans. And that is surrounded by a wall that is both physical and magical. And then around the outer city is the area that, I know there's a term for this and I need to look it up so I can sound like I know what I'm talking about and have a word to describe it, but all the farmland and everything around the city that provides food and everything else that the city needs, right? Well, around that is, you guessed it, another wall that is both physical and magical. And then around the whole thing is a mythal, and the mythal prevents teleportation, among other things. And, you know, these series of walls and magical wards and the mythal are what protect the city from extraplanar things and undead and everything else that's out in the wilds, right? Well, obviously, a village doesn't have the... I mean, I guess a village could have a wall, right? But you think about, you know, your stereotypical D&D village, and it seems obvious that it's not going to have these kinds of defenses. So what happens is, what villages there are, some of them are just left over, like they're ancient from, you know, olden times when things weren't so dangerous, and just they've managed to hang on somehow. A lot of them end up getting wiped out eventually. And at this point in the timeline, most of the villages that still exist because they have some kind of patron or guardian that protects them. So my idea is a village, there might be a powerful wizard that lives there, right? And he personally protects the village. He set up his own wards and everything that keeps everything out and keeps the village safe. But as you're probably already guessing, problems happen when that wizard dies, right? Then the village is on its own, and then it's usually wiped out not too long after that. So because of all this, I didn't want to start my campaign in a village. Well, I could, right? I could. And that could be really interesting. And I definitely want to run a campaign that starts in a village. But the other thing is that, as I've discussed on the show, one of my philosophies behind building this world is I want to give my players as much freedom as I can, and all the way down the character creation. And so, you know, I told him, I'm like, here's all the options of things you can do. And, you know, you saw my party. I've got a Goliath, a tiefling, an Eladrin, an Azamar, and a human. I mean, it sounds like a joke, right? Like they walk into a bar, what's the punchline, right? So it's hard to imagine these guys being all from the same little village, right? And it's like, yeah, I could come up with like they're traveling or whatever, but it's like, I really wanted them to have a place that they're from and have that be in the story. So I was like, you know what? I just need to grab the bull by the horns and make a city. So Alondria is my city. And a funny thing, I just came up with the name Alondria because I needed a name for the city. And it was literally the day we were going to play. And I had ideas for my city that I come up with. But, you know, I've told you I usually save the name for last. But I was like, I need a name. Like, this is going to be super lame if I, you know, if we do our session zero tonight and I don't even have a name of the city that they're in. Right. And for some reason, I started with Alexandria because I was trying to think of a city from like the ancient world that kind of was like kind of what I want my city to be, because I wanted it to be a very kind of cultured place. So I thought of Alexandria and I'm like, well, let's end it in Ea or Rhea, you know, like Alexandria, you know, let's end it with that sound to kind of invoke that and make it sound like it's a city, right? And then I just started throwing around syllables and playing with stuff, and I came up with that, and I'm like, oh, that sounds cool. I like that. It's easy to spell, easy to pronounce. It has a cool sound to it. I like it. And I'd come up with this idea of having it originally be an elven city that has since been expanded upon by humans. And so I'm like, okay, cool. And so before I get to the next part, let me tell you a bit more about Alondria. So the inner city I mentioned was the part originally built by elves, and it's, you know, the buildings are magically grown instead of being built. So it looks very different than the human part of the city outside of it. And as far as the human city, I'm picturing kind of a blend of different medieval European styles of architecture, but especially like the German style of architecture, where you have like kind of the white buildings with the beams that you can see from the outside. I don't know what the term is for that. Hopefully someone knows what I'm talking about, or I'll figure it out. And the next time I do world building, I can say this type of art. But what we, at least here in America, think of is like traditional German architecture. You know, like if you go to, I don't know, like here in Washington, we have Leavenworth, Washington, which is kind of a German town. And they have a lot of buildings like that in the downtown area. So you might know what I'm talking about. But anyway, that's kind of what I'm picturing for the town. And it's kind of funny because you see that architecture a lot in D&D illustrations, or at least in 5th edition, I've been seeing it a lot. And again, surrounding the city is miles and miles of farmland. I need to figure out like how big that area really needs to be for it to work. Alondria is on the coast of the ocean and at the mouth of a great river. And I'm thinking this river is kind of this continent's version of the Mississippi River. So it's a river, it flows north to south. It's a big river that all the other rivers in the continent feed into. And in olden times, when travel on the river was more common and trade, it was the main north-south trade route of the area. So kind of like how the Mississippi River was in Native American times before the Europeans came, when the various Native American groups would trade all up and down the Mississippi, and you had Cahokia was one of the big cities on the Mississippi, which is now St. Louis. That was originally Cahokia, and there's still a pyramid there, or what's left of it. But yeah, so that's kind of how this river is, which I just realized I need to come up with a name for the river. Ships still ply the river, but they are fewer and more far between. Each ship is heavily protected by magic and people. The same is true of seagoing ships, which are even fewer. So that's kind of, you know, what I'd come up with. So we start our session zero and we're going through characters and everything. And I'm talking with Steve, who is playing an Eladrin. And I don't really know much about the Eladrin other than what's in the book, because I didn't play fourth edition. But what I've gathered from what's in the book is that they're a subrace of elf that is more closely tied to the Feywild than the other elves are. So now we have this idea that elves came from the Feywild, which I think must be a fourth edition thing, because I don't remember ever seeing that before. And believe me, I was heavy into elves in the second edition days. So if that was out there, I would have found it. But I dig that. You know, now we have the Fairylands, which I think probably in my world, I'm going to end up just calling it Fairy instead of calling it the Feywild. Or maybe I'll call it Arcadia, back to the Changeling, the Dreaming days. But anyway, that's where the elves are from originally. So the Eladrin are a group of elves that are more closely tied to that, and for the most part still live in Fairy or the Feywild or whatever you want to call it, or whatever I want to call it when I decide. So I asked Steve, you know, and before you email me, that may not be what the Eladrin were in fourth edition. I don't know. That's just what I'm saying they are in my world. I'm just making them another elf subrace. And so I asked Steve, I'm like, well, do you think your character is maybe from the Feywild? So he came up with the idea that he had been exiled from the Feywild, and he was really digging how, you know, the inner city of Alandria was of elven make. And he's like, well, maybe that's why my character is here, because, you know, he came here for whatever reason, but then he stayed because the elven part of the city like reminds him of home. So then I thought, okay, well, let's take that a step further. And let's say that Alandria actually has some kind of connection to the Feywild that, you know, we can figure out later what that is, or I can. You know, maybe there's a portal to the Feywild there, or maybe part of it exists partially in the Feywild or something like that. And so we thought that was cool. And then it was only then that I realized how similar the word Alandria is to the word Eladrin. So then I was like, well, maybe we'll just say that Alandria in Elven means city of the Eladrin. And yeah, so I mean, that was just a happy accident. I know for sure I was not thinking anything about the Eladrin when I came up with Alandria. I was just trying to think of something that sounded cool and wasn't hard to pronounce or spell. And by the way, I spell it Eladria, like literally the simplest spelling I could think of for those sounds. And it just turned out to be very similar to the word Eladrin. I mean, it's literally, I believe, the same letters in a slightly different order and an extra A thrown in. So that's kind of cool. And, you know, that kind of stuff, sometimes it almost sends like a shiver up your spine, you know, when those cool serendipities happen and things kind of just start to fit together. And sometimes you wonder, you're like, you know, did my subconscious know about this all the time? And some, you know, deep part of my brain kind of already figured this out. And now my conscious mind is just realizing it. And it seems like, oh, this just magically happened. I don't know. But I'm having a lot of fun with building this world, and I'm having a lot of fun with having the players involved with it. Kyle, for his character, came up with this brilliant backstory, very, what's the word, kind of mythological. And that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to like make his character's backstory like seem like something out of a myth. So he grew up on the top of this mountain, and he fell down the mountain and was found in the valley by a magical, intelligent speaking toad who raised him and taught him the ways of the mountain and whatnot. Very cool stuff. Nathan, for his character, has come up with a whole kind of school for the Order of the Immortal Psionicus that I believe it's called the Order of the Butterfly. I don't remember the exact terminology, but really cool stuff. Like he came up with, he chose for his psionic disciplines, celerity, which is all about speed and maneuverability, which is the butterfly part of the order. And then the, one in second edition was the psychometabolism. I forget what it's called. I forget what the discipline, but it's basically psychometabolism, which is all the making yourself physically stronger and hardier and stuff like that, which is the cocoon part of the whole butterfly thing. So really cool stuff he came up with. And there's they're kind of how they present themselves to the greater world is they are a dancing school. So think like ballet type dance, you know, like performance dancing. And they use that as they're, you know, training people to dance. They're looking for people that have the right energy to be a psionicist. And once you're chosen, then you have to make a pilgrimage to the actual monastery, which I guess Nathan said is in a valley. I really wanted it to be on top of a mountain, like the old, you know, kung fu thing, like you have to climb the mountain. But his is in a valley, which is cool, you know, kind of changing things up a bit. But you have to make this pilgrimage in X amount of time, and it's a really difficult journey to be able to train into deeper mysteries, which is psionics. If you don't do that, you're just learning the dancing. You're not learning the mojo that goes with it. So, you know, really cool stuff. Really cool stuff. We've got Chrissy and Dwayne. Dwayne's playing a tiefling, and Chrissy is playing an Asimar. And they have some kind of relation between themselves through their human parent. I think they're originally thinking about being brother and sister, but now they're like uncle and niece or cousins or something like that. So that's going to be interesting to see how that develops. And yeah, so, you know, every player has brought something to the table, has brought something to the world to just add to the richness of it. And all of these things are things that I would have never thought of on my own. I would have never come up with a school of the butterfly dancing school. And, you know, so I've decided that my city of Alandria, part of their culture is they love to dance, you know, and it makes sense now that there's this dancing school that's also psionicist in the city, because people of Alandria, they love to dance. So again, you know, that's something about my city that's directly because of what Nathan decided to do with his character. And also Steve, who is playing the Blade Singer, who is a dancer. So we have two dancers in the party. So yeah, people of Alandria love to dance. And that's just because of what Nathan and Steve decided to do. And yeah, I don't know. I don't want to offend anybody or anything, but sometimes I feel like the old school way of, you know, the DM, you know, cloistered by himself, creating his masterpiece world that he's going to unveil to the players. If that even really, like, did Ed Greenwood even do that? Or was he getting feedback and ideas from his players all along that he was implementing? I mean, who knows? Ed knows, right? I don't know. But that whole idea to me just seems so old-fashioned and just so limiting. You know, I mean, a group of people is going to have way better ideas than one person every time. And it's just a lot less stress. You know, I think one of the reasons that I never took the plunge to create my world is I would look at things like the Forgotten Realms campaign setting and be like, oh my God, you know, they've got days of the week, months of the year, their whole calendar with their, you know, days that aren't in the months. And they've got all this geography and all this history and all this crap. And that's what I got to do to have a world. And it's like, well, no, you don't, you know, but that's how I used to think. And I think that's part of the reason why I never did it, because I was like, I don't want to do all that. I don't know if I can do all that. But now it's like, no, I don't need to do that, you know. It's like right now I've got the city. I have an idea of where it is as far as it's on a coast. There's a river. The terrain nearby is very kind of hilly, leading to mountainous and forested. I'm kind of basing it a little bit on the Pacific Northwest as far as what the terrain looks like. But that's all I got, and that's all I need. And then whatever else I either come up with on the fly or I have the players help me come up with. And you know, I've got great players. They have great ideas. And what I've been working on is a way for us to collaborate outside of the game. And I personally use OneNote as like my world guide for the campaign, where I keep all my stuff organized. And I just recently figured out that I can make internal links in that to take me to other parts of the OneNote document. So for instance, if I mention Primordia, I can have that be a link that if you click on it, it takes you to more information on Primordia, the goddess. And I also figured out that I can share it with my players to where they can read it, but they can't edit it. Now I can change that and give certain people the ability to edit it if I want, but now at least, you know, if they get OneNote, which you can get for free, then they can go and read through all my notes and get some information about the world. And then if there's anything that I don't want them to know, I don't know, I guess I have to put that in a separate notebook for GMs only. What I'm really wanting to do is I'd like to have something like a wiki online where I can have all my information and everything's internally linked, so you can go from place to place and you click on keywords to take you to an article about that and stuff like that, and have that where I can say, okay, these people can edit this or add to this, and everybody else can just read it, and have that like on the internet publicly so that you could go and read about my world if you wanted, but you couldn't get in and edit it. But if I had certain players that said, hey, I want to be able to add stuff, then I could give them that ability to edit and add stuff. But I haven't found a good way to do that yet that isn't like going to take a ton of time for me to learn how to do it. So I might just do it on my website, because at least that, I mean, I found some other ways to do it, but they would all be way more complicated than just doing it on my website. And the reason I'm trying to find another way to do it is so that it's not as complicated as doing it on my website. But the problem is like, I want it to have the functionality of a wiki, but I don't want it to be a true wiki, because I don't want just anybody to be able to go in there and edit it, you know? And it's like Wikia, I looked at Wikia and it's like, well, it's a true wiki. If I put it on Wikia, then anybody can go in there and put anything in there they want. And I don't want that. So I've got a good way to share it with my players now. Unfortunately, I don't have a good way to share it with you. So, you know, if you want like written stuff about the world, like maybe you want to take some of these ideas for your own world, or maybe you want to do something with my world yourself, like run games in it yourself, let me know, gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. And I could at the very least make some blog posts about it and share some of this stuff with you. So that's going to wrap it up. I thank you for listening to this. I apologize if it's a bit more rambly and disorganized. I just kind of did this off the cuff. And yeah, again, I'm kind of ill. So I don't know. Hopefully it'll turn out all right. We'll find out when I edit it how well I did. But yeah, if you want to reach me, you can email me, gamemasterjourney@gmail.com. Check out the website, starwalkerstudios.com. You can find all the podcasts there. You can find all the show notes. I'm on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. I'm on Google+, Lex Starwalker. I'm Lex Starwalker everywhere. If you want to sign up for my newsletter, you can do so at the bottom of the show notes. I haven't actually sent one out yet. I need my wife Nikki to help me kind of get that set up so that I can send out nice newsletters. But you know, I'm not going to send out more than one a month, so I'm not going to spam you with a bunch of crap. But at most one a month, just kind of letting you know what's going on with the various shows in the studio. And I think that's it. I think you know all this stuff anyway, right? I don't need to tell you this stuff. You already know. Thanks for listening. And thank you to everyone I've gotten so much awesome feedback on the world. You know, I get ideas from people. I just get encouragement from people, just people saying, hey, you know, I'm digging the episode or whatever. And I really appreciate that, because you know, just like writing, you know, GMing can be kind of a lonely thing to do. Obviously not when you're running the game, but, you know, when you're prepping and you're world building and all that stuff, you spend all this time in your own head. So it's kind of nice to share my ideas with you and that people like listening to it. And, you know, I've had a few people tell me that I've inspired them to start building their own world, which I think is awesome. And I realized recently that, you know, I blather on about my world all the time, and hopefully like it's helpful to you, but I don't really do much like pedagogy. Like I don't really do any like, well, this is how you build a world. that might be a little pretentious of me to do because this is my first time doing it, but if you have any specific questions or issues with world building that you'd like some help on, shoot me an email or tweet me or leave a comment on the website, whatever. And if I can, I will answer your question or I'll do my best to address it and help you out as much as I can. And if it's something just completely beyond me, I'll try to find the answer somewhere and let you know. Cause I'm learning too. So if you ask me a question that I can't answer, it's probably a question I'm going to end up asking. So it's not at all bad for me to go research that and find the answer for both of us. So anyway, thank you so much for listening. I want to thank all the patrons for your support. I want to thank everyone who's donated on the website for your support. I want to thank people who've left reviews on iTunes and Stitcher for your support. And I just want to, you know, just thank you for downloading and listening. And, you know, thank you to all the people who share the podcast with other people or, you know, retweet my tweets or share my Google Plus posts or whatever, you know, just even the little things like that, like really help out. It helps other people find the show. It helps the audience grow. And if nothing else, it just lets me know that people are listening and people care about what I'm doing. And it motivates me. Like, here I am today. I'm like sick, you know, I should probably be in bed, but, I wanted to podcast. I wanted to talk about Primordia and I wanted to make some content for you so that, you have good content to listen to and help you with your D&D world. If you're making a world or for another game or, just give you some RPG stuff to listen to. And I'm still looking for feedback on the review and if people are interested in more reviews. So far, everyone I've heard from really liked the review and would like to hear more reviews, although not, you know, nothing but reviews. And don't worry, this show's never going to become just reviews because I wouldn't enjoy doing that. But it is something I could do every once in a while. At the very least, you know, when I get a book, whether I just go buy a book because I want it or someone sends me a promotional copy, at the very least, I can review those. So, yeah, I'm happy to do the reviews. It makes me feel good that people like the reviews because I work really hard on them. And I mean, I read reviews a lot. If I don't buy something online, I at least look it up online and read reviews of it before I go buy it. And I myself really value, you know, the middle of the road reviews. Like, you know, you read those reviews where people are just foaming at the mouth and just ranting and raving because they hate the thing so much. And it's like, this is useless to me because you are so emotional just from your language. You're so emotional that I don't really trust anything you say because I don't know if this is really how you feel about it or you're just mad because you hate, I don't know, Wizards of the Coast, or you're mad because you hate the Forgotten Realms or whatever, but your language is very emotional. And so I have a hard time putting much weight in what you're saying. And the other side of the spectrum are the fanboys, which is a lot of the reviews you read, where they're just like, they love everything about it. And if I read a review of anything and it doesn't say anything critical, it's just like, oh, this is great, this is awesome. I'm like, I can't listen to you either because you're so biased. It's so obvious. You know, nothing is perfect. You know, you there should be something that you're like, oh, I wish this would have been a little better. If you've got nothing critical to say, you're probably just a fanboy and your review isn't useful to me. So it's hard to find, you know, middle of the road reviews where someone's like, this is what I liked, this is what I didn't like. I'm not saying it's all good. I'm not saying it's all bad. I'm saying this may or may not be for you. Here's what I think. Make your own decision. It's hard to find reviews like that. So that's what I try to do. And based on the feedback I've gotten so far on Sword Coast Adventures Guide, that's what I've accomplished. That's what people are getting out of it. I'm having people telling me that, you know, it's a good kind of unbiased review. So I try. So it makes me feel good that the people appreciate it. But I'm still looking for more feedback. So if you have an opinion on that, let me know. All right, so obviously I'm rambling, so I will stop. I hope you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week, and I hope you have a chance to do some world building. You know, even if you're not ready to take the plunge, just throw some ideas down on paper. You might be surprised how many ideas you really have once you start putting them down, and you might be surprised how well they start to connect together, and you might be building your world before you know it. Give it a shot. And if you do, let me know how it turns out. Thanks so much for listening. Game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music provided by Cloudwalker, Renfield, Tranceboy, and Ish. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.